Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty Moscawane has the day off. This week, volatile conditions surrounding the Trump presidency became even more intense. Two of President Trump's formerly close associates are facing jail time. Michael Cohen, Mr. Trump's ex-attorney, on Tuesday implicated the president when he pleaded guilty to charges including campaign finance violations. And Paul Manafort, the president's former campaign manager, was found guilty of bank fraud and tax charges. Then, late Thursday, President Trump lashed out at Attorney General Jeff Sessions, and Sessions pushed back. How are Republicans and Democrats reacting? Is there more to both the Cohen and Manafort stories? And what next for President Trump himself? Our guests this hour include Rebecca Davis O'Brien, reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Welcome to the program, Rebecca.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Andy Wright is senior fellow and founding director of the news and analysis website Just Security. Andy Wright is also, he was associate White House counsel to President Barack Obama. Hello, Andy. Good to have you with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And before we begin, lines are open at 888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes at whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So suffice it to say, it has been an extraordinary week. Andy, let's briefly address the latest developments in the relationship between President Trump and Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Tell us a bit of the back and forth that's happened over the past 24 hours.
Yeah, so the president has been publicly attacking Jeff Sessions. I think that it sounds like the White House was expecting Sessions to manage with a heavy hand the Southern District of New York situation, that it was outside of his recusal that precludes his involvement in the Manafort matter. However, the Cohen matter, at least two of the counts relate directly to the 2016 campaign, which would be covered by Sessions' recusal. So on one hand, I think Sessions feels that he can't act as a matter of law on Department of Justice recusal regulations, and the president continues to see the role of attorney general as someone who's supposed to protect him rather than be the chief litigator of the United States and chief law enforcement officer of the United States. So in a pretty astounding move, Jeff Sessions issued a public rebuke to the president by saying that while he's attorney general, he will not be allow the Department of Justice to be affected by improper political influence. So it was a pretty astounding interaction over these last 24 hours.
And it almost seems as if in a tweet earlier, Andy, that the president was trying to strike a conciliatory note, kind of mapping out what he wants Jeff Sessions to do moving forward. Is that your take?
Yeah, I mean, I think right now the president seems to be sort of grasping at straws in various directions. I think it would be good to take the temperature down a little bit. The president ought not be commenting on these matters at all, and the Department of Justice needs space to be able to do its job without, you know, passion or prejudice.
Rebecca Davis O'Brien, before we move on to the Cohen and Manafort cases, do you have anything to add to what Andy said about this extraordinary exchange between the president and his attorney general?
Right. Well, even just this morning, President Trump's tweets, echoed some of what I have to say. We've had some reader feedback, of course, saying, what about the other investigations that we'd like to see the Department of Justice undertaking? Why don't we look at corruption on the other side? And that's pretty remarkable. But it does serve in part to or maybe it's an attempt to draw attention away from the swirling investigations that are coming out of New York and the verdict, of course, in both Cohen's case and Manafort.
Yeah. Well, let's get to Michael Cohen. He pleaded guilty on Tuesday to multiple federal crimes. Rebecca, just briefly, what did he plead guilty to?
He pleaded guilty to, two counts of campaign finance violations that he said were crimes that were directed in part by the president, then-candidate Trump. And he pleaded guilty to five counts of criminal tax fraud and submitting false statements to banks.
So the campaign finance violations occurred ostensibly to keep an individual from revealing information that could harm the candidate's campaign. Who was the individual in this case?
There were two individuals. The first was a payment. He helped facilitate a payment to Karen McDougal, former Playboy playmate, who alleged a sexual encounter with Donald Trump more than a decade ago. And the second instance, which was a payment he made directly to Stormy Daniels or Stephanie Clifford shortly before the 2016 election.
So, Andy Wright, what's your take here? I mean, what are the implications for the Trump presidency?
Well, it's, you know, having worked in two White Houses, one of which was under siege in the Clinton White House and one of which was not, you know, under Obama, you know, I've never seen anything like this in my lifetime in terms of the president's close advisors, both his lawyer and his campaign manager, getting convicted. And what was particularly astounding was Michael Cohen getting up in court under oath and claiming that the president had directed him to undertake criminal activity, that he had coordinated with the candidate, then candidate Trump, to do so. And so under federal criminal law, to the extent that Michael Cohen was engaging in criminal behavior and Donald Trump was directing him to do so, Donald Trump faces significant criminal liability himself for under either the theory of aiding and abetting or conspiracy or perhaps solicitation of criminal activity. So it's really unprecedented.
Rebecca, Michael Cohen once said he'd take a bullet for the president. Remind us of why this all changed so dramatically in that relationship.
Right. Well, so the investigation into Michael Cohen was well underway before those April 9th raids on his home, office, and hotel room, which were contemporaneous with subpoenas served to David Pecker, the CEO of American Media Inc., and to the organization and the Trump Organization. After that, you see a quick deterioration in their relationship, culminating in there were some personal issues for Mr. Cohen that emerged in the spring. There was a private conversation that my colleagues and I reported yesterday between him, Mr. Cohen, and his father, who's a Holocaust survivor, who was disappointed or despairing that his name might be dragged through the mud by President Trump. A lot of personal pressure, and, you know, if you read the criminal documents that were filed against him and that he pleaded guilty to, there's a fair amount of some of the crimes implicated his wife, Laura, and that, you know, typically we see that coupled with the severity of tax fraud, which tends to be easier to prove in court. You see that put a lot of personal pressure on him as well.
Yeah. So as part of this deal, is Laura Cohen then off the hook?
You know, they don't really indicate that she ever really was, it's hard to say, it's hard to read the tea leaves there, but I think that could have, because of her involvement there, that could have been very tricky legal, personal area for Michael Cohen. I think that, and he still could face prosecution in related matters, but this does alleviate a lot of the pressure. They sort of put the bazooka away, and he seems to be, it leaves open the possibility of cooperation, certainly.
Yeah. Well, on Thursday, we did learn that federal prosecutors have granted immunity to David Pecker, whom you mentioned just a moment ago, chairman of American Media Incorporated. You know, he's been a close ally of Donald Trump over the years, decades, really. Andy Wright, what do you think? What might he possibly add to the case if indeed there's a case building against the president?
Well, to the extent that that the National Enquirer was engaging in capture and kill of stories that were negative to Donald Trump, and that Donald Trump was facilitating that in some sort of criminal way with respect to the campaign, then American media is going to have all the documents and financial transactions associated with count six that Michael Cohen pleaded guilty to this week. So they'll have a lot of the other sides of the transaction that Michael Cohen allocated about with respect to that count. And perhaps there may be other stories out there that we haven't come to light yet that they may have information about. And so, you know, I think that's one of those big question marks about what else are they talking about potentially over at American Media.
Yeah. And a catch and kill is when a publication buys the rights to a story and then the story is shelved, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. And Rebecca, to you, you know, again, Pecker is a longtime friend and associate of Trump's. This might involve some speculation on your part, but do we know what the motivation is here to talk to prosecutors?
You know, what's interesting about the Pecker side of this is just from a reporter's standpoint, we learned later on that he had been subpoenaed personally. And obviously my colleagues who've done remarkable pathbreaking work on the American media side of this, going back to before the election when we broke the story about Karen McDougal's deal with American media. His role here has been, he's obviously has had a long relationship with Mr. Trump. And the fact that he has been so quiet and that the subpoena remains so quiet and that he has been sort of a subterranean piece of this investigation. And now it kind of has been, the fact that he has immunity or had immunity to speak to prosecutors suggests that he had a lot to tell them. And, there was this amazing moment in court when Michael Cohen pleaded guilty and said that he did so committed the campaign finance violations at the direction of the president. We wondered, was there somebody else backing it up? And it turns out that it was David Pecker. So certainly it seems there could be more to come from him.
Andy Wright, do you know of a smoking gun here? Is there a sense that there's something lying in wait that could make this much worse for the president?
To my mind, the smoking gun happened when Michael Cohen allocated and accused the president of crimes under oath. And to me, the smoking gun evidence will just be the various financial backup and the backup of people like Peckham, who, can corroborate that story. I mean, my sense is Peckham got subpoenaed, probably said he was going to assert the Fifth, and then negotiated immunity from there because he saw a real criminal liability. So friendships, go a long way, but it's hard to hold the line when you're facing potential criminal sanctions and jail time when that friend gets caught up in real trouble.
Yeah, Rebecca Davis O'Brien, let's get to the Stormy Daniels story for just a moment. In October of 2016, Michael Cohen used a home equity line of credit to finance a $130,000 payment to the adult film star. Daniels is suing Trump and Cohen. She wants to void an agreement to stay quiet. Do you know what the latest is on this story?
I was just wondering about that. She's been rather quiet, and she and her lawyer have both stayed remarkably quiet since the charges came out. And I'm still sort of digging myself out from under a heap of email as a result of these stories. But I think that the question is whether this rests, puts to rest her role in this. I'm not sure. I mean, there's still, the big question, obviously, is what exactly, when you say that the direction of the candidate, what does that mean? What kind of direction is that? How was that direction communicated to Michael Cohen and others? We know that there was one or more people in the campaign who was involved in the discussions with David Pecker to keep allegations quiet. We'll see what happens, but it'll be interesting to see how the women involved here, what their role is going forward, certainly.
Tuesday was one of the most consequential days of the Trump presidency. We're talking about it with Rebecca O'Brien, Wall Street Journal reporter covering white-collar crime, and Andy Wright, senior fellow and founding editor of Just Security. Andy was also associate White House counsel for former President Barack Obama. Lines are open, 888-477-9499 if you'd like to jump in. Also, you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Keep it here for more of Radio Times. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in today for Marty Moscowane. On Tuesday, President Trump's former attorney, Michael Cohen, implicated the president when Cohen pleaded guilty to charges including campaign finance violations. Also, Paul Manafort, the president's former campaign manager, was found guilty of bank fraud and tax charges. We're talking about the possible fallout from these events with Rebecca O'Brien, Wall Street Journal reporter covering white-collar crime. Andy Wright is senior fellow and founding editor of Just Security. And again, if you'd like to call us, the number is 888-477-9499. Andy and Rebecca, we have an email from Karen who says, back to the David Pecker question, there's a lot of immunity and plea deals I don't understand, but I'm most interested right now in understanding why the special counsel has offered David Pecker immunity. What does it mean regarding what the investigators know and what they want to know? Can you kind of sort through that a little bit for us, Andy?
Sure. So first of all, it wasn't the special counsel that offered immunity. It would have been the Southern District of New York prosecutors, career prosecutors working out of there, because the Cohen matter is actually being operated out of that jurisdiction. And what the immunity deal really says most of all is that the prosecutors were more interested in Pecker's information than they were in trying to, prosecute him or move against him. So when they're faced with a choice with a witness who has basically an absolute right to assert the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, even before a grand jury, if they give immunity under this case, U.S. Supreme Court case called U.S. versus Castigar, then that person can be forced to testify because they've now been given immunity such that they don't face any legal prosecution for what they say. So in that, what it really says is that he had some information that the prosecutors really wanted to get. At the time, it looks like Cohen was a target. He had directly relevant information in terms of negotiations with Cohen and financial records. And potentially, if those prosecutors are interested in the conduct of Donald Trump, he may have very important information on that score as well.
Rebecca, is it possible that Special Investigator Robert Mueller will want to get into this some more with Michael Cohen? And is Cohen, to the best of your knowledge, required to cooperate according to the plea deal?
You know, they leave this stuff rather open, and I would tend to, defer to Andy here. But I think that Lanny Davis, one of Michael Cohen's lawyers, has certainly signaled his interest in cooperating with the special counsel. And you have to imagine that as President Trump's longtime former lawyer, and, given that he had access also to some of the family business, he would be potentially of interest to the special counsel's office as well.
Yeah, Andy, Lanny Davis has been very open in saying Cohen has more to say. What do you make of this?
Yeah, I mean, it's actually a little bit peculiar that they didn't nail down a cooperation agreement before Cohen pled guilty. So, to my mind, I think there's something a little bit fishy going on there. I can't be that the prosecutors didn't think he had more information to offer, or that, I doubt it was that they thought he was such a unreliable witness that they couldn't use him in any other future prosecutions against other people. So my guess is that given that Cohen's lawyer was a very senior person in the Southern District of New York who has real credibility there, that they basically decided to do a handshake agreement that Cohen would plead guilty now, get the information on the books before we get too close to the midterm election cycle, and they would continue to negotiate in good faith about what credit he would get for cooperation. So that's my best guess right now, but it is a little bit strange.
All right, Andy, let's get to the Justice Department's policy of not indicting sitting presidents. We've got a comment from Bob who says, it doesn't say in the Constitution that the president can't be charged with a crime. When people say that, they're referring to a memo from the Justice Department in 1972. Where are we with this? Does the Constitution permit criminal proceedings against a sitting president? What are your thoughts?
Well, it's ultimately an unresolved question. And now, as a practical matter, the Office of Legal Counsel's opinion related to Richard Nixon, and that opinion was also affirmed at the end of the Clinton administration, says that it's Department of Justice's view that it's unconstitutional for the president, a sitting president, to be indicted. And of course, since the department prosecutors are bound by that constitutional interpretation, one would not expect them to move forward with an indictment. Now, that said, independent counsels in the past, Ken Starr, considered whether or not it was possible to move forward. And I believe their internal legal memoranda suggested that they might be able to move forward with a prosecution. The interesting question about whether this would actually get tested is if, for example, New York moved forward with a prosecution against the Trump Organization. There's been reports that there's an investigation now related to tax crimes. And if that moved towards President Trump, Department of Justice policy does not apply to New York State prosecutors. So that could really actually tee that kind of a question up if someone moved forward with an indictment. But I think it's basically an academic question for the time being. I do not imagine that Special Counsel Mueller would seek to indict a sitting president. I think rather he would either do a presentment in front of the grand jury or just issue a report. And then allow the political process and the impeachment process to play out as it did. Now, of course, the Constitution is quite explicit that a president can be prosecuted after they leave office.
Yeah.
The impeachment clause specifically exempts pardon power from being able to pardon someone who is removed from office on impeachment grounds. So that also, that liability potentially remains, notwithstanding whatever the ruling is as to whether someone who's in office can be subject to indictment.
Rebecca O'Brien, let's get to reaction to all this on the Hill. How are Republicans taking all this? And let's talk about, we'll talk about the Senate Majority Leader, the House Speaker, but also, you know, Representative Tom Cole, who's a former House Republican campaign chair, you know, warned, quote, where there's smoke and there's a lot of smoke, there may be fire.
Well, fortunately, I'm not charged with, my job does not involve me looking at the political ramifications here just yet. We've had plenty of stuff to keep us busy in Manhattan courts this week. But I will say that what has struck me is, I mean, the fact that it's been kind of quiet. I haven't heard that a huge amount. And that's rather telling to me. And, you know, of course, there are these, this, you know, amid talk of indicting a sitting president, you have to just think about the mounting legal pressure here. There are three open inquiries related to Mr. Trump right now. We have the federal investigation into Mr. Cohen, which is ongoing and could lead to more charges later. There's the special counsel. There's the Trump Foundation lawsuit led by the state attorney general in New York. Yesterday or last night, the New York Times wrote that the Manhattan District Attorney's Office is looking into potential charges against the Trump Organization. And we know that President Trump himself gets very, there's a defensiveness about his personal businesses and about his family. Well, that kind of, you know, the there was pressure on Michael Cohen because of his family. If there's pressure on the president because of his family and his businesses, you know, what I guess his reaction is what I'm looking for, looking at right now.
Andy Wright, so, you know, and Democrats, and of course, we're ahead of the midterm elections. Are they playing it safe in reacting to the events of the past week? Are we hearing the word impeachment loudly from any of them?
Yeah, I mean, I the events of this week are going to shape the entire tone of the midterm election cycle. And so to the extent that the president, has put Republicans in an awkward position when they go home to their districts to talk to their districts, because they're going to have to be talking about Michael Cohen and Paul Manafort, whatever it is they say, rather than, you know, before they can clear that brush and get to talking about taxes or regulations or health care or other issues. And for Democrats, they had already started a message on chaos and corruption in the Republican Party, controlling Congress and the White House. And I think this plays into that message. Now, that hand could be overplayed potentially, especially in certain swing districts. But I think that all of these indictments, including several indictments of sitting members of Congress in the Republican Party who had been early endorsers of President Trump, really feeds into that narrative of chaos and corruption. And that I think that has to be a net benefit to the political environment for Democrats.
Why don't we talk a bit about the power of tweets versus the power of convictions. Dan Balls of the Washington Post writes that presidential tweets eventually disappear into the ether, while Tuesday's convictions could send people who've had close relationships with Donald Trump to prison for several years. Is there more to this, though? I mean, it seems as though, you know, Mr. Trump's tweets do have a certain power to rile not only his base up, but many of us in the media. What do you think, Andy?
Yeah, I mean, so the basic, there's a legal defense and there's a political defense. And so the legal defense is not helping, you know, President Trump's not helping himself at all with his Twitter. He's only hurt himself and he's only put himself in more legal jeopardy by creating a narrative and more, you know, false assertions about what has happened in various states. But it is having an effect on the political side. In terms of freezing Republican members of Congress who are more afraid of primary politics than they are general elections right now than persuadable voters. So if, you know, 40% of the country is with President Trump very solidly and 60% is very angry with him, that 40% that is with him can win primaries in most of the districts. So right now that's what's motivating Republicans. And so in that sense, the tweets are actually alleviating some pressure. It's at least holding the hand, staying the hand of more aggressive measures by Republicans in Congress for the time being. But it also may lead to them having to pass their gavels to the Democrats, and then all bets are off.
Rebecca,
I was going to say, sorry.
No, jump right in.
Sorry, did that end? sort of what we were talking about, just touching on earlier, one thing that did jump out at me yesterday in sort of the response to all of the to the plea is, you know, I think one thing we want to watch is Brett Kavanaugh's nomination, because, sure, you know, I think that, you know, we have Senator Schumer calling for the delay of that, of those hearings. And I think that's going to be a kind of a canary in a coal mine, maybe, and to see, you know, how lawmakers respond to that, how the nominee himself responds to that, and how that weathers the midterm election in wake of the pleas and the guilty verdict.
Rebecca, do you have an early sense of how that might play out? How much of a delay there might be? And I've got, yeah, I'm asking a reporter to speculate, so I apologize, but just a sense of what's going on. So it's not
like way off my beat.
Well, then I won't do that to you.
If I were in the prediction business, I would have no business at all. So, but I do think that that's going to be it's a discreet and clear, rather than, again, not talking about tweets and not talking about how people are vocally responding. That's a concrete,
sure,
action or inaction that will be rather telling, I think.
Yeah. Well, let's get back onto firmer ground here and talk about Paul Manafort, President Trump's former campaign manager. You know, found guilty Tuesday on 8 counts of tax and bank fraud. And there was a mistrial, I believe, Rebecca, on the other 10 counts. Could you just kind of give us the Cliff Notes version of the story here?
Sure. I mean, again, I did not cover this. I did not cover this trial, but he's facing another trial in that upcoming month.
Yeah.
But I think it's what's rather interesting here is that, as with the Michael Cohen case, which I did cover extensively, we have a longtime or an associate of President Trump, certainly, whose personal business dealings were their undoing, Paul Manafort now faces a sort of difficult decision. He faces the rest of his life behind bars. He did not make a deal with prosecutors, and he certainly knows he's in a position to know a different sort of side of the Trump campaign than Michael Cohen did. So what he has to offer, mm-hmm, potentially in the wake of his guilty verdict to prosecutors or other investigators is probably something that we should be paying attention to also in the coming months.
Yeah. Well, and Andy, as an observer, you know, and again, you know, with his Manafort's conviction and upcoming time behind bars, you know, there's some thought that this might just persuade Manafort to cooperate with the Mueller investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election. You know, as somebody who works in the legal profession, is it your thought that perhaps this is happening behind the scenes to perhaps flip Manafort?
Well, I would assume that the special counsel's office would be open to some sort of approach by Manafort's folks to try and alleviate further liability. He faces a lot of counts, more counts in D.C. than he did in the Eastern District of Virginia. Mm-hmm. And so this is a window for Manafort to make his claim. He also, you know, they had that trial in Virginia because Manafort refused to waive venue on tax counts because he thought he'd get a more favorable jury in Virginia than he would in D.C. And so he rolled the dice on that and lost. And so now he's facing a more inhospitable territory in the District of Columbia. And by the way, that D.C., those D.C. charges relate to his failure to register as an agent of a foreign government. And it will involve a lot of ties to Russia and Russian-backed Ukrainian political entities. So the narrative of the second trial, should it come, will be much closer to the Russian collusion issues than they were in the Eastern District of Virginia, where it was really much more focused directly on financial crimes. Although, even in that trial, there was a big subtext about Russian collusion, because part of Manafort's defense was that, you know, this former Russian intelligence agent was a co-signatory to some of the accounts overseas, and therefore Paul Manafort wasn't really responsible for the taxable income. So even there, even though it wasn't, you know, front and center, and the judge didn't want them talking openly about the Russian connection, it was present in that trial, and it'll be on full display if they go forward in the District of Columbia.
And let's talk about the potential timing of all this alongside the midterm elections, Andy.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, as this proceeds, you know, the Justice Department doesn't indict people in that window usually going into a midterm. But if people are under indictment and they have speedy trial rights, et cetera, that court calendar will take on a logic of its own that's not connected to the midterm. So there, I'm guessing there will be quite a few court appearances between now and the midterm elections that will just continue to feed fuel to, reporters like at the Wall Street Journal, et cetera, that are doing all this great investigative reporting right now and give them new column inches to report.
Yeah. Rebecca, you want to weigh in on that at all before we move on?
Well, we love having things to report, although I'd like to take a vacation at some point. So
it might be a while.
Week off. Yeah. I think that, and again, to get, circling back to the tweets and to Jeff Sessions, that stuff is I think of it as a distraction from what is going to, trials are great theater, but they also, you get a lot of great materials out of trials. I always love covering them. Because you can sort of see a narrative taking shape that doesn't come out in the charging documents. And that Manafort trial, as Andy pointed out, is going to really touch more, hew more closely to the central issues of Russian collusion, allegations of Russian collusion here, and could be really damaging for the president and the party leading up to the election.
So with this week's conviction in mind of Paul Manafort, are there indications that President Trump might pardon Manafort? Solid indications. Rebecca, what's your sense?
Well, again, this is based not on my own reporting, but I believe that there were reports earlier this week that he had considered pardoning Manafort, and his legal advisors had advised against it.
Okay.
For a number of reasons. On a Cohen side of things, there is the fact he's facing state charges, although there are some complications with double jeopardy laws in New York State. It wouldn't really help necessarily. I can't speculate as to what, every time I try, I get it wrong. So I think that's something to watch for, although obviously there's still this trial coming up, and we'll see if in advance of that there are, Paul Manafort makes any offers or makes some sort of gesture toward cooperation that might hinder any or prevent any hopes you might have of a pardon.
We're up against a break here. Right back with more of Radio Times in just a few moments. Stay with us. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Tuesday was one of the most consequential days of the Trump administration, with Paul Manafort's corruption conviction and Michael Cohen's guilty plea. And here to parse some complicated legal issues, Rebecca O'Brien, Wall Street Journal reporter who covers white-collar crime for The Wall Street Journal, and Andy Wright is senior fellow and founding editor of Just Security. Andy Wright was also associate White House counsel for Barack Obama. And the lines are open, 888-477-9499. You can send us an email to radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let's get briefly to Rudy Giuliani, the president's current attorney. Giuliani has acknowledged that President Trump reimbursed Cohen for the $130,000 payment to adult film star Stormy Daniels. Andy, more of a help or a hindrance to the president these days, Mr. Giuliani?
Well, Rudy Giuliani is doing what I think he was brought in to do, which is to go win news cycles on TV and to throw enough sand up and dust up in the air that it gives people a little bit of pause, helps the base get a permission structure to stay with the president. But it's not a very good legal strategy, because he continues to make representations that suggest either that the president is lying, that Rudy Giuliani is lying, or that Rudy Giuliani just doesn't have his arms around the facts well enough to be out there commenting on it. So, I would generally say that best practices for lawyers would be to, make sure that every single statement they ever make about their client's conduct is 100% true, or at least in good faith, their best estimate of what is true, and that they're authorized to make that representation, notwithstanding their attorney-client privilege relationship. And I think Rudy Giuliani is out there to sort of, do jazz and riff with people and just continue to sort of help win news cycles for the president rather than a real legal strategy.
Yeah. I've got an email which asks, Mr. Cohen does not have an agreement to cooperate with the special investigator or the attorney general in the Southern District of New York. Why wouldn't he have an agreement before pleading guilty? Without an agreement, what's his motivation to provide additional information? Rebecca, I'm not so sure that I'm completely understanding this question here. And so therefore, I'm going to just kind of throw that your way to see if there's anything you can pick apart there since you've been covering Mr. Cohen extensively.
Yeah, well, actually, Andy addressed this earlier on the show. It's unusual that he would go into this without a cooperation deal in place. But from our reporting and sort of reading between the lines, I think it's safe to say that his plea came together at the last minute. He was facing an indictment on more than double the amount of charges that he ended up pleading guilty to. And last weekend, his lawyer, Guy Petrillo, helped hammer out this deal. And I think it's safe to assume, or it would be not, it's a good idea to assume probably that, that he did so with an understanding and the trust of that office in Mr. Petrillo in particular, that the cooperation would take shape after the plea. I also think that, you know, they were facing a sort of Justice Department guideline to not bring these charges so close to an election. And you saw, I mean, getting, and again, touching on the Giuliani stuff, there's been so much back and forth, volleying of accusations and tweets and lies, you know, allegations of lies over the past few months as this investigation's unfolded in the public eye. I think that it takes a little bit of heat off of Mr. Cohen and the prosecutor's office, frankly, to have this plea out of the way so that the work of potential cooperation can take place behind the scenes. You know, there is, of course, there's no guarantee of this, but I think in this case, it was probably a good, you know, I think both sides see it as a potentially win-win situation.
Yeah. President Trump has stepped up criticism of the Mueller investigation for quite a while now, actually. Sometimes we hear of it on an almost daily basis. Andy, remind us, can he shut this down? And if he were to, what might the fallout be?
Well, you know, the president, in order to shut down the Mueller investigation under the regs, the Department of Justice regulations, he would have to basically force the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, to remove Mueller for cause, because the regulations suggest that the special counsel cannot be removed, you know, except for some sort of cause. Now, so the president probably could functionally do it, but it would probably require a Saturday night massacre type of scenario where, you know, the Attorney General and Deputy Attorney General become casualties of removal on the path to shutting down the Mueller investigation. I think the consequences would be catastrophic. I think they'd be much like the firing of Archibald Cox, special Watergate prosecutor, by Nixon. And, you know, what that bought him was Leon Jaworski, who had been the head of the ABA. And, you know, the investigation continued. And I just want to say for one moment that, you know, this is not a witch hunt. I mean, there was a Russian intelligence influence operation, crimes committed on the path to doing that in this election. And this started as a counterintelligence investigation of that influence. And the Trump obstruction of justice narrative and thread of that investigation is actually kind of a sideshow. And it's something that is entirely the president's fault for how he's been reacting to that original investigation. And so I certainly think that the American people have an interest in knowing what happened with respect to the Russian active measures and crimes committed against our democratic process. And on that path, I think the president would be much better served if he would just allow that to take its course and minimize his liability rather than trying to discredit the intelligence professionals and law enforcement professionals who are trying to find that out for us.
Going back to the Justice Department guidelines that were referenced just a few moments ago, and I'm not sure either of you has the answer to this, but is there a September 1st deadline for Robert Mueller to drop his investigation? This is for Rudy Giuliani, and this has to do with keeping clear of an election, you know, so that undue influence isn't asserted. Is there a solid deadline to the best of your knowledge, Rebecca? And again, you might not have this information at your fingertips. I'm throwing you a curveball here.
One to Andy.
Okay, Andy, do you know of it? I'm trying to determine.
There's
so much stuff flying around, as you mentioned before. Let's see if we can get on some sort of solid ground here.
Yeah, there's absolutely no deadline for Mueller to wrap up the work of the Office of Special Counsel on September 1st.
Okay.
There may be a window between September 1st and the election in which new indictments cannot be brought. So it's not, you know, and other types of investigative disclosures might have to take a break so that there's not the appearance of Department of Justice influence in the election cycle. But so there may be some types of activities that would not be undertaken during that election window. But there, by no means is there some sort of, you know, Robert Mueller has a week to finish the work of his office kind of claim.
Let's get a characterization of the culture these days in the White House. For instance, President Trump has said he surrounded himself with the best people. And then the Washington Post's Robert Costa reported recently that White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow hosted Peter Brimelow. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, but he's the publisher of a website that promotes white nationalism. And this was at Kudlow's house recently. So a characterization, your impressions of the culture of the White House at the moment. Andy, you want to take a stab at that?
Well, you know, look, without characterizing President Trump personally, you know, he has a set of policies that are a ton of racial bias. He has a history of racially charged perspectives on criminal defendants, on people who are refugees and immigrants. And, you know, it has been enough to bring on the worst of the white supremacy and neo-Nazi groups to follow him. They like what he's saying. They like what they're hearing. And so I'm not surprised that there are sort of people trying to glom on and attend briefings and fundraisers, et cetera, who are going to have those affiliations. You know, I don't make any claim to know what is in Larry Kudlow's heart
or what
the vetting process was for that. But I'm not surprised, like the Russians trying to infiltrate the Russian, you know, the Trump campaign, that there are white nationalists who are trying to sort of infiltrate the Trump orbit generally because they've liked what they're hearing.
NPR's Domenico Montanaro has characterized President Trump as a bare-knuckled fighter. Mr. Trump has encouraged people to, quote, you know, in his words, hit back five times harder than they ever thought possible. Is he doing so on his part by doing things like stripping former CIA director John Brennan of his security clearance? What are your thoughts on that, Andy? And then if Rebecca, if you want to weigh in.
Yeah, I mean, so the first thing I'll just say is when you're a New York real estate developer and you want to squash someone who's, let's say, a contractor who you don't want to pay their bill or you're having some sort of dispute with, hitting back five times harder is a pretty effective strategy because you've got the bigger, you're going to be the last person standing. Your organization's probably going to win, and you can probably drag it out in a way that's going to win in court, too, as well as in the public space because you have a bigger megaphone. When you're president, it's a little bit different because when you start fighting people like, say, Stormy Daniels at issue in the Cohen plea, you elevate them. You know, Omarosa is elevated by fighting with President Trump. She's going to create its own ecosystem to be a presidential critic that ends up having its own fuel, and you get media attention and you get to build your megaphone by picking that fight. So I'm not sure that what has worked for Donald Trump as a businessman is working for him as president.
So, and you brought up Omarosa, former staffer, Omarosa Manigault Newman, who is promoting her new book, Unhinged. She made some news here over the past few weeks, but any credibility there from what she is ostensibly saying about her experiences in the White House? Has there been any confirmation of some of the inflammatory stuff she said? Rebecca, to the best of your knowledge, have you picked up on anything? Or Andy? Maybe we'll move on from that one.
Omarosa did come up. She's had some dealings with the National Enquirer's publisher, American Media. We reported earlier this year that she had spoken with federal investigators, and that she also had some dealings with David Pecker and American Media. So, behind the scenes, there's the bluster that's out there in the books and Twitter. But behind the scenes, this legal process is playing out in which, Stormy Daniels has a microphone, but she also has, Stephanie Clifford also has a a lawyer, and she has been, you know, her story's been told through the guilty pleas and through these charging documents. So I think it's important to distinguish between these two things. And I'll also note, going back to Giuliani's stuff, that part of the reason that Omarosa, you know, we saw Omarosa has turned against the president. We've seen Michael Cohen turning against the president. Part of that is precisely because Donald Trump and the people who are enacting his, you know, in this case, Giuliani is acting as representative, go after people. And we reported in our story this week that Giuliani's acts of publicly distancing the president from Michael Cohen were part of the reason that Michael Cohen, what led him to flip was this sort of sense of being isolated from the president. And I think sometimes those, not only does the president's action in these kinds of, or his retributive sense of self-protection or justice, it not only elevates these people, but it also can push them into the arms of law enforcement, for example.
Andy, let's get to an interesting article you wrote earlier this month in which you drew some parallels between the investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election and 1996, China and then Vice President Al Gore. Give us, if you would, the quick version of those parallels that you drew.
Yeah, sure. So I was a young Gore staffer, and I was one of his lawyers right out of law school. And during the 1996 campaign cycle, there was an apparent effort by Chinese intelligence to infiltrate or influence Democratic Party policy with respect to Taiwan and China and other issues that they cared about with technology transfer, et cetera. And the Democratic National Committee was, seeking to raise money to compete and aggressively. And they had an Asian Pacific fundraising arm that ended up turning out to have several people who were engaged in illegal straw donor donations. And of course, to Vice President Gore's chagrin, he went to what he thought was sort of just a political community outreach event at a Buddhist temple in Los Angeles. And it turned out that a bunch of the nuns there who had taken vows of poverty turned out to be straw donors to try and funnel money into the campaign. And that caused an uproar and a criminal investigation and congressional investigation on the Hill that was partly calculated to try and damage Gore before he ran for president in 2000. I think it partly succeeded in that.
We have less than a minute left, so maybe in about 20 seconds, how did the Clinton-Gore White House react?
Well, they didn't talk a lot about it. They let the process run its course, and I think in doing so minimized their risk. They also never took the position that there was no Chinese influence full stop, and so they left that sort of open, and in that sense they sort of sided with the idea that Democratic elections should be free and clear of interference, and whoever was engaged in wrongdoing should be held accountable.
And just quickly, as out of curiosity, as a young attorney for Gore, what was it like being in the middle of such a maelstrom?
It was busy and exciting, but we also felt like it was important because there were legitimate issues that needed to be investigated, but they also could be used for political attacks, and we wanted to make sure that it was sort of conducted responsibly and there was a good outcome, and but protected our boss, who we knew was innocent of wrongdoing.
All right. On that note, we've got to wrap it up. Andy Wright, great to talk to you today. Andy was Associate White House Counsel for former President Barack Obama, and he is Senior Fellow and Founding Editor of Just Security. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Rebecca Davis O'Brien, good to have you with us as well.
Thanks so much. I'm happy to be on the show.
Rebecca Davis O'Brien reports on white collar crime for The Wall Street Journal. As always, we invite you to touch base with us here at Radio Times. Head to whyy.org/Radio Times. Our engineer today has been Charlie Kyer. Our producers, Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for tuning in to Radio Times.